We've seen over the course of the books of Samuel up to this point. Some key events or some general patterns. Rose. Okay. Okay, so we've seen the decline of Saul. We've seen the rise of David, and we're kind of asking, I suppose, at this point, has David peaked? Has he started to experience his own decline? We've seen, several faltering steps, right, with his son Absalom, dealing with the coup he presents, with the rape of his daughter by one of his sons, and his handling of that. This is part of a larger pattern at work in Samuel, right? If we go all the way back to 1 Samuel, we open the book with this kind of demise of Eli and this rise of Samuel. And what is one of the key points where that comes to a head? Anybody remember? It has to do with the passing of office from one generation to the next, right? As Eli's sons are where that kind of demise of Eli and rise of Samuel come to a head. But then that's involved also in kind of not really the demise of Samuel, but the fading of Samuel from the scene and the rise of Saul, right? What is the catalyst for the people asking for a king, right? They've wanted a king for a while. God has expected and provided for them having a king for a while. But what's the catalyst that leads them to ask for a king? Frustration with Samuel's sons. Yeah, frustration with Samuel's sons. Right, at that passing of the office from one generation to the next, right? The sons are kind of the place where it all comes to a head. Right? With Saul, it's a little bit different. Why does it come to a head for Saul? Because he's a terrible person. Right? But think about it from the Israelites' perspective. We talked about this last semester, last year. I don't know. It's been forever. it's been fun, for me at least, but it's been a while. Right? What happens with Saul's decline? And what does it look like from the Israelites' perspective? Right? What did they want in a leader? Not what did God want for the Israelites in a leader, but what did the Israelites want in a leader? Jesse? They wanted to be like the other nations around. And in what particular way? It's 1 Samuel 8, if you're trying to track down the particulars. But why did they want a king like the other nations? They want him to fight their wars. They want a king who will bring them military success, right? Specifically, they want a king who's strong on national defense, right? Who's going to provide them a sense of security. And Saul, does Saul do that? I love that qualification. Yes, to start. Yeah, they get what they want, right? They get exactly what they want. They get only what they want. They get a king who's strong on national defense and not much else. Right? How does he inspire the various tribes to come together to fight? Yeah. Yeah. He chops up a team of oxen and says, if you don't come, we're coming after you, and this is what it's going to look like. Like, okay, I guess I'll show up for the draft. But then he wins, right? But what causes his decline over time? Jealousy, yes. There's so much to the portrait of Saul and Samuel, right? As David begins to rise, right, we see that pattern that we saw with Eli, we saw with Samuel. Right, David begins to rise, and in the midst of that, Saul begins to decline. But we see Saul begin to come to pieces before David enters the picture. It accelerates very quickly once David enters the picture. But it begins before David enters the picture. And where do we see it? God, through the mouth of his prophet Samuel, says, right, do X, don't do Y. And Saul doesn't do X and does do Y. And he does that a couple of times. And so, first, he's rejected from being king. And then, his dynasty is rejected as well. Sorry, it happens in the opposite order. His dynasty is rejected, I believe, and then he is personally rejected. Which is interesting because that's 1 Samuel 13, 1 Samuel 15, and in between in 1 Samuel 14, we see his son, Jonathan, going off on his own with his armor bearer to face the Philistines, right? Here was our hope for dynasty. No, we're not going to get dynasty. And look at the missed opportunity we had with that, because Jonathan is better than his father. Right? As we move forward, right, Saul comes to pieces even worse. Think about the picture of David and Goliath in chapter 17, 1 Samuel 17. We meet David in chapter 16. He's anointed king, and he enters Saul's service to do what? To sing. He does not first enter Saul's service as a soldier. He first enters Saul's service because Saul is going mad as a spirit from the Lord comes to taunt him. And David's music soothes Saul. Then we move into 1 Samuel 17 with David and Goliath. And, right, the Israelites are lined up on one side, the Philistines are lined up on the other, there's a valley in between, and what's going on? The biggest, baddest, tallest Philistine comes out from the Philistine ranks and taunts the Israelites. What was noted in the physical description of Saul that made it kind of a laughing matter when he tried to hide when they wanted to make him king? He's a head taller than all of the other Israelites. The Israelites have their own giant, as it were. They have their own successful warrior who should, because of his office, if nothing else, be going out and fighting the Lord's enemies. And what's he doing in 1 Samuel 17? He's cowering in his tent like all of the other Israelites. And then David enters as somebody who's not even supposed to be on the battlefield, right? He's supposed to be home tending the sheep. He's not old enough for the draft, right? But he enters the picture and acts as the warrior king that Israel wanted out of Saul and is no longer getting and also needs, right? And there's this curious phenomenon at the end of that chapter where Saul seems to have no idea who David is, right? And that gets, right, he's told who David is, he's told who his family is. Jesse must be really proud because he doesn't have to pay taxes anymore. But that leaves us kind of uncomfortable at the end of 1 Samuel 17. Like, what happened here? And the narrator never resolves this for us. Is it these chapters are narrated out of order? Right? Like, this actually happened before the events in chapter 16, and we're expected to get that from what's described. Or is this just one more place where we see the effects of Saul's slow unraveling? That someone who's been in his presence, whom he's had the opportunity to know intimately in previous weeks, he doesn't recognize when he's standing before him. Right? Don't know. But that is the moment when, right, the decline of Saul accelerates, right? It's like we move off of the city streets and onto the freeway. It gets really bad from here because Saul continues to come to pieces as David, now in military service on Saul's behalf and promoted to the position of a general, becomes more and more successful, right? As Saul is less and less so. Yeah.
Who is, you know, we always talk about him, you know, like Saul's armor is too big for him. Well, maybe it's too big for him, but what he says is he hasn't tested it yet.
Yeah. Something that happens when people read scripture, right? There's this, there's a motto among critical scholars that says we should read the Bible like any other book. I agree with that as far as it goes, right? In that the skills that help us read a book well are the same skills that will help us read scripture well. The problem is that they'll say that, and what they mean is not we should use the tools that help us understand the plot and understand the point an author's trying to make. What they say, what they mean by that actually is we should read it as though it has no authority whatsoever. And they use that then as an excuse for not reading it in a way that you would read any other book, right? If you pick up a book at Barnes & Noble and you read through it and there are two chapters next to each other like this and there's something weird happening between them, you're going to assume the author did that on purpose. And there's something there you're supposed to get out of it. Or it could be they're a bad author, yeah. If it's a book that's been around for more than 200 years, that's probably not where you're going to go, unless you're a student who has to read it, right? But this funny thing happens when people read the Bible. We encounter the same kinds of things that happen in our TV shows, in the books we read, in short stories, where the author's doing something and just hasn't come right out and told us exactly what it is, and people will assume, oh, there's some mistake, or there's been several layers of editors and nobody apparently read the final draft before it went to the publisher, right? There may be layers of editing, but why would we assume that they're asleep at the wheel and have no idea what's going on, right? So when we have something like this, we should always assume it's on purpose, even if we cannot yet explain why, what it is and what it does, right? And that's actually something that invites us to ask more questions. Another feature of that, piggybacking on what Duane pointed out, right? He's known as already a man of war and a man of valor in chapter 16 when he's put into Saul's service to play an instrument for him. So whether that means chapter 17 happens earlier and he's younger or not, right? And not necessarily, right? He, as we meet him in the narrative, we already know that he has that potential, even though Saul and David's brothers seem to be surprised by it. So I think so. I think one of the things the author may be doing is as we're kind of following Saul's slowly coming to pieces, the disorder in the narrative kind of forces us along for the ride, where we're experiencing these kind of jolts and switches and jerks as we're not sure what's happening when and how that affects us. I think it really enriches that portrait of Saul coming to pieces as we kind of feel that reading the narrative. So good. We could spend all morning talking about 1 Samuel 17. It's worth a close read in multiple translations. There is far more going on than you realize. And I'll just leave you with this. If you weren't with us previously, pay very attention to the descriptions of the armor. The armor Goliath wears has particular features that the armor Saul offers David does not have. Not every translation captures that level of detail. So it's worth rereading in multiple translations and paying very careful attention there. Wait. Let me see. I think the New American Standard skips over it. Yep. Yeah, the New American Standard skips over it. Or sorry, the ESV, rather, skips over it. I don't remember if the New American Standard captures it or not. But it's comparing verse 5 to verse 38. There's a difference of detail in the armor. But I'll let that, I'll let you track that down and figure it out. Where we've been in 2 Samuel, right? So David has established his kingdom, right? Saul dies in battle, right about the transition between 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. It takes David some time to consolidate the kingdom. Judah's ready to have him. It takes a little longer to convince Benjamin and the rest of Israel that they should have David as king, right? Because Saul was a Benjaminite. And Saul has sons. And Saul has military officers who are still around. David's commander, Joab, doesn't really help matters. That's a really interesting thing as we read Samuel. Joab seems to act as a free agent. And sometimes he's under David's control. And sometimes he's not under David's control. So he both poses a threat to David and is free to critique David at various points. But as we move through 2 Samuel, right, everything looks like it's going amazingly. And then we get this note, right, where in the spring of the year, when kings go out to war, David stayed home. Right? And that's 2 Samuel 11. And okay, David's getting older. He has a military he knows he can trust. He has a military commander. It's better to have him out in the field than around. So maybe this isn't alarming at all. Maybe this just shows us the kind of security David has. Except that's not what happens. David's out wandering his roof at a time that he should be out in the field with the army. He sees something he shouldn't see. He rapes a woman, kills her husband in the attempt to cover it up. Thinks he's gotten away with it. Right? And then Nathan comes. Right? Nathan comes and confronts him in chapter 12. David repents, and David is forgiven. But David still has consequences that he will experience. And the primary consequence is, right, the immediate consequence is the child dies. And the continuing effects of that sin, as Nathan lays it out for him, is that the sword will never depart from his house. Right? But then, right, 2 Samuel 12 wraps up with Solomon being born. And given the name Jedediah, right, the Lord loves him. Rabbah is captured, which gives you an idea of how long this takes, because Rabbah was under siege at the beginning of the chapter. Rabbah's captured at the end of the chapter. There's this interesting interchange between David and Joab, right, where Joab says, you better come and finish this off, lest they name the city after me. And that's kind of a double-edged comment. Is that right? Especially because Joab's been involved in the entire cover-up. Right? But maybe everything's fine. Then we get chapter 13. Right? where David's son Amnon rapes his half-sister Tamar. Absalom bides his time, and that Absalom is Tamar's full brother, also David's son, but half-brother to Amnon, right? Absalom bides his time and devises a way to have Amnon killed. Right? And in echoes of Job, right, the messenger arrives to tell David that all the king's sons are dead. And they're not. It's just Amnon. Absalom flees. Absalom comes back. And now, as we're experiencing with David what's happening to him, what may be David's peaked, and now he's, right, we're asking the question in this part of Samuel, have we begun to see David's decline? And if so, are we seeing in David's decline the rise of Absalom? Right. So Absalom comes back to Jerusalem. Absalom instigates a conspiracy and a coup. David has to flee the city before Absalom gets there, taking his household with him. One of the things that Absalom does, echoing the consequences that Nathan spelled out for David, right? It was the usual course of events in the ancient Near East. When a king comes to power, having defeated the previous king, he would take that previous king's wives into his harem. Well, Absalom does that as he enters Jerusalem. The concubines David left to look after things, Absalom takes to himself in a very public manner, right? This is not Absalom being a jerk, although he is, right? This is Absalom making a political statement. I have defeated David. I am the king now. All that was his belongs to me by might, right? You may not give it to me by right, but I'm going to take it anyway because I can. I'm the king now. David's on the run. As he's on the run, right, he's cursed by someone from the tribe of Benjamin who's like, right, everything that happened to Saul is all your fault, and now God's cursing you for it. In chapter 17, a close friend of David who had been his counselor, Hushai, is sent back into Jerusalem to offer his services to Absalom, sorry, he's been a counselor for David. He's sent back into Jerusalem as a spy, right? To see what intelligence he can gather for David. And we don't know what's going to happen, right? We do, because we've read the rest, or we know what happens in the rest of the book of Samuel at some point. But imagine that it's this coming out in weekly episodes, right? Oh my gosh, to be continued. Right, he's in Jerusalem. He sent messengers that almost get caught. They have to hide in a well, right? And they bring David the news that they're coming for him, and so they cross over the river so that they'll be safe and they have more time to prepare. Then we get to chapter 18, and we don't have to say to be continued yet. You guys want to read chapter 18 together? Love that question. Duane's asking, is there a parallel between David's handling of the situation with his children and Jacob's handling of the situation with his sons? Right? Where there's an obvious favorite, there's hatred between siblings, and there are things in the text that should make you think that there's a parallel. Yeah. And the daughters. Both daughters get raped. So. And the fathers seem to have no hand in any sort of vengeance carried out by the brothers. So another thing that should make you ask, am I supposed to see a parallel here, is the description of Joseph's tunic, or Joseph's coat, is the same description given of Tamar's tunic. Whether it means long-sleeved or many-colored or embroidered, it's an obvious, it's visually distinct, and it displays favoritism or care or a special love for the one who wears it bestowed on them by a parent. So, all right, in Joseph's case, it's probably saying he's the one who's going to get the double portion, right? Imagine how Reuben feels about that. I mean, we get a pretty clear spelling out of how Reuben feels about that. And for Tamar, it seems to be something that belongs to all of the king's virgin daughters. But it's the same description of that clothing. So there are several things that make us, right, think of Jacob and his sons and daughter when we're watching David and his daughter and his sons at this point. Yeah. I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear. Yeah, so Reuben makes plans. Reuben's role in what happens to Joseph is so much more complex than his other brothers, right? I think Reuben has a better sense of the politics of the family than his brothers do. His brothers just want to kill Joseph. Reuben, I think, wants, not for Joseph's sake, but for his own, he wants what Joseph's coat of many colors symbolizes. He wants the position of authority as well as wealth that that double blessing entails. And how better to get it than to arrange for losing Joseph, the favorite son, and then be responsible for restoring him to dad. So I don't think Reuben is the least bit concerned for Joseph's safety. So, yeah, we're looking at two chapters at the same time. That's looking at Joseph and Tamar. Did I keep saying Absalom instead?
No, you said Tamar,
but, I mean, are you talking about Dinah? That's the complexity of what we're meant to see, because there are clear callbacks to Genesis, but it's Dinah and Tamar who are raped and then avenged by brothers. But it's Joseph and Tamar who have the particular garment that distinguishes them and marks them as favorites, right? Who then suffer at the hands of brothers. Yeah. That's a good question. And in both cases, it's the father's handling of the family that contributes significantly. It's the sins of the father that contribute to the suffering of the children. So that's, I love when someone will say something like, you know, there's polygamy in the Bible, so that means it's justified, right? Have you read about the family lives where we see polygamy in the Bible? I don't think we're supposed to see from this that it's okay. I think we're supposed to see from this, without anybody bothering to explicitly say so, that it will not go well for anyone involved. Right? So. Okay. 2 Samuel 18. We ready? Then David mustered the men who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. And David sent out the army, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the men, I myself will also go out with you. But the men said, you shall not go out, for if we flee, they will not care about us. If half of us die, they will not care about us. but you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it is better that you send us help from a city." The king said to them, "Whatever seems best to you, I will do." So the king stood at the side of the gate while all the army marched out by hundreds and by thousands. And the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders about Absalom. What's different, by the way, here about David staying home while the army goes out versus earlier? That's one way to take it, is that he looks weak here. What's another way? What else is afoot here that's not afoot when he stays home and encounters Bathsheba?
He's given counsel not to, or something.
Yeah. He's counseled not to. There's a specific strategic reason for him to do so. Right? The entire reason for the army going out to face another army that's coming after them is keeping David safe, getting to David. So if he stays behind a wall while his army goes out in his defense, he's secure. Right? If he goes out with the army and because of that is taken or killed in battle, then it's all for naught. So he's definitely not showing forth strength here. But there is a specific, there's a specific strategic reason for him staying behind. So, good. And it's important that the narrator makes sure we cannot miss that everyone knows, from the generals to the privates in the infantry, everyone knows that they're supposed to deal gently and deal well with Absalom. Verse 6. So the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the loss there was great on that day, 20,000 men. The battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. And Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. I love this. Absalom earlier was praised for his physical appearance and physical beauty. And his vanity was wrapped up in that description, especially in relation to his hair. That's preparing us for what's about to happen. Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak. And he was suspended between heaven and earth while the mule that was under him went on. And a certain man saw it and told Joab, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak." Joab said to the man who told him, "What, you saw him? Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt." But the man said to Joab, "Even if I felt in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, 'For my sake, protect the young man Absalom.' On the other hand, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof." Joab said, "I will not waste time like this with you." And he took 3 javelins in his hand and thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. And 10 young men, Joab's armor-bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the troops came back from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained them. And they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a very great heap of stones. And all Israel fled, every one to his own home. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself the pillar that is in the king's valley. For he said, "I have no son to keep my name in remembrance." He called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's monument to this day. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, "Let me run and carry news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies." And Joab said to him, You are not to carry news today. You may carry news another day, but today you shall carry no news, because the king's son is dead. Then Joab said to the Cushite, go, tell the king what you have seen. The Cushite bowed before Joab and ran. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, come what may, let me also run after the Cushite. And Joab said, why will you run, my son, seeing that you will have no reward for the news? Come what may, he said, I will run. So he said to him, run. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and outran the Cushite. Now David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof of the gate by the wall. And when he lifted up his eyes and looked, he saw a man running alone. The watchman called out and told the king. And the king said, if he is alone, there is news in his mouth. And he drew nearer and nearer. The watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called to the gate and said, see, another man running alone. The king said, he also brings news. The watchman said, I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, he is a good man and comes with good news. Then Ahimaaz cried out to the king, all is well. And he bowed before the king with his face to the earth and said, blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king. And the king said, is it well with the young man Absalom? Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant, your servant, I saw a great commotion, but I do not know what it was. And the king said, turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood still. And behold, the Cushite came. And the Cushite said, good news for my lord the king, for the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all who rose up against you. The king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man. And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son. Tell me what you see in the chapter. What stands out to you? Where do you see possible references to things that happened earlier? How does the passage break down?
I can't help but wonder if David feels that way, if he'd rather be a guy instead of Absalom. Why do you follow it? Like why not just say, okay, another kingdom?
I think we're striking there on perhaps another reason that they wanted David to stay behind, actually. If we see in this moment when David receives the news, right, that David is weeping for his son and wishing that he had died instead. That raises the question, why all of this? Why any of this at all? If David truly means that, why didn't he just hand over the kingdom to Absalom? But I think also his men could see this coming in a sense and didn't want David on the battlefield. So.
I've always kind of wondered, where was the army when David was fleeing? It seems like it would be easier to defend Jerusalem than to flee and then...
Maybe that tells us something about the extent of Absalom's conspiracy. But yeah, why would David leave a fortified city that he spent most of his reign building up in order to leave it for Absalom to just take over and establish himself in? Yeah, where was the army that's with David now? Are they actually that small in number in relation to Absalom? Were they somewhere else? Yeah. Were they off somewhere with Joab and then rejoined David here? Is David trying to avoid a confrontation that would see Absalom killed and then Absalom chooses to pursue him? Lots of questions there. But why would David ever leave a fortified city? That's a really good question. Perhaps he feared that Absalom had people inside the city already. What else do we see? Yeah, the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. Yeah. Yeah. Wild country. What has happened on two previous occasions when someone brought David what they thought was good news? They get killed on the spot, right? Someone brought him news of Saul's death. Someone who thought, who may not actually have been involved at all, may have just run across Saul's dead body and stolen some things and then been caught with them and decided, aha, maybe I can get some reward for this, right? And it's an Amalekite at that, one of the people Saul was supposed to have wiped out and didn't. And then when do we see that again? Right, he's killed on the spot. Right, he says, I killed Saul. David's like, how could you dare to stretch out your hand against the Lord's anointed? But when do we see it again? What happens as David reigns over Judah? Does he immediately reign over Israel as well? It's about 7 years where there's a king of Israel and a king of Judah, right? And they have some skirmishes, but David treats that king of Israel with regard and respect, right? And so when he's killed, and the men who did it come to David to offer this to him. Like, look what we've done for you. We've enabled you to become king over Israel now. How does he respond to them? Yeah. You have killed a righteous man in his sleep. Right? And they're killed on the spot. So. Here, once again, right, someone is bringing David what they think is good news. I wonder if that is part of what Joab is doing, where he is unwilling to let Ahimaaz bring the news. Because the whole army knows that they're supposed to have dealt well with Absalom. And the one Joab gives the job is completely unabashed. He doesn't mention it first, but he shows no shame in proclaiming that Absalom is dead.
He doesn't share the details, though.
He doesn't.
Yeah. It's very clear in their
reporting that it wasn't. That's true. There's a distinction in the news that's brought, right? That the one who brings the news of Saul's death, the ones who bring the news of the, I've forgotten his name, but the king of Israel's death, they take responsibility for the death. They think they've done it as a favor for David. And it's clear that they took advantage of the one they were killing in order to do it. And here, nobody bothers to mention, yeah, Joab did it while Absalom was stuck in a tree and couldn't do anything to stop it.
It makes me wonder, like, why did he stop being there? Like, why? He's not going to give the news.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Why did Ahimaaz do this? Why did he want to be there? Did he want to soften the blow of the news to David, perhaps? I don't know. What's up with Absalom, by the way? Look at the descriptions of Absalom as he's killed. Are there details that stand out to you there? He's suspended between heaven and earth. In a tree. He's a king's son. A son of David.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's, we get that from earlier. There's no explicit connection to his hair here, but it's mentioned earlier how long, how curly, how beautiful his locks are, right? The women of Judah are swooning as they read the description, right? We even get how much his hair weighed after its annual cropping. And here, right, he's riding on a mule, right, a king's mount underneath a tree, and he gets caught by the head. So he's suspended on a tree between heaven and earth, the son of David, who's then killed. There's a reward of silver pieces, disgust, in connection with killing him. What's that make you think of? He is. He's also pierced with a spear in the side. Right?
I never thought of it before, but is that almost like a foreshadowing of the son of the king of heaven?
Yeah.
Which obviously is the sin of the father at this point.
Yeah.
In the case of Christ, God the Father, it's not that case. But
yeah.
It's also still in the king's line, which Christ comes from.
So there are these specific detailed parallels, but there are also these troubling things that don't fit that I think also draw out the contrast, right, between what the death of Absalom does and what the death of Christ does, right? His death helps reunite, but his death is also because, right, because of his own sin, for sure, but also, right, the title over this whole section of 2 Samuel, right, is that the sword will not depart from your house. So the sins of David, in a sense, lead directly to this as well. So. Oh, yeah. It's 10 o'clock. Go ahead.
You know, they have the curse as a man
who
is in the tree.
Yeah.
The only two, like really the only three people I can think of that in is this Absalom, Judas, and Jesus are the only, like, what are any other characters we know of?
Haman. It's a gallows, but yeah. If we can call the cross a tree, we can call the gallows that Haman prepares a tree, which he intended for someone else. That's a good question, right? As we read, we should look for, are there others who end up suspended from a tree in that way?
I have one other question.
Sure, go ahead.
Zadok's son, it seems like he doesn't say that he was killed. Like he doesn't seem to tell David. Do you think he knows or do you think he intentionally?
I think Zadok knows. Yeah, Zadok is there. Ahimaaz is there. I think Ahimaaz knows full well that Absalom has been killed. I think partly he's softening the blow because he knows David's going to get that news. And maybe there really was a commotion as he was leaving. But I don't think he doesn't know that Absalom is dead. I think he just chooses not to disclose that to David at this juncture. Yeah. There's so much more here. So much more here. But it's after 10 o'clock. So why don't I pray for us? Let's get some coffee, some cookies, if there are any left. So, good. Lord, thank you for your word. Thank you for the ways that it grows with us. How we love and appreciate its stories growing up as we read them, and then we return and read it again and find that there's so much more there than we realized. Father, we pray that you would invite us to a deeper love of Scripture, a deeper engagement with it, that we would continue to become better readers, more attentive readers, that we would get more, that we would be surprised and enthralled by what you've given us in your word, and that through our increasing and ever-deepening engagement with it, you would grow us in grace. And we ask these things in Jesus' name.